Tonight we're studying in the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews, a great chapter dealing with matters of faith, hopefully to encourage us and help our faith to increase. And so we want to open our Bibles to the 11th chapter in our study this evening. But before we do that, I want to go back and review just a little bit from the beginning of the book of Hebrews. As we look at the first chapter of the book of Hebrews, what becomes the theme of that chapter? Christ is better than... All right, it's better than the angels, but it begins with better than the prophets. All right, better than the prophets. In the second chapter, better than the angels. In the third chapter, better than Moses. And in the fourth chapter, we see identified, let us what? All right, that's right. And then the latter part of the fourth chapter, an introduction to the priesthood, how that Christ is priest after the order of Melchizedek. And then in the fifth chapter, the priesthood continues to be discussed until we get to an interruption. What is the interruption about? All right, that's right. And then continuing down through that chapter to the last verse, once again, the priesthood of Melchizedek continues. And in the seventh chapter, we see that Christ is priest after the order of Melchizedek, and therefore no more need for priest after the Levitical order. And then in the eighth chapter, what continues? Better covenant. That's right, a better covenant. And then in the ninth chapter, Randy, what's discussed there? We see a contrast being made between what? All right, the old covenant and the new covenant under the guise of the materials of the old tabernacle versus those things that are part of the more perfect tabernacle. And then in the 10th chapter, what's being discussed? Chris?
Better sacrifices.
Better sacrifices. That's right. Now as we... Pardon me? Better sacrifice. That's right. Singular. Than what existed under the old system. Now in the 11th chapter, we see beginning at verse 1, the writer is demonstrating or describing a kind of faith that saves. And he says, now faith is assurance of things hoped for, a conviction of things not seen. Now here is an explanation. Faith is confidence or assurance and conviction. It's the substance of things hoped for, that which undergirds and supports, literally to stand under, to be a foundation. And it is the conviction of things not seen. Conviction of what? What is it that we don't see? Well, the Apostle Paul, you'll recall, in the latter part of the fourth chapter of 2 Corinthians, describes things that he saw without seeing them. And then in the fifth chapter, he tells us what that was. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning at verse 16, he says, wherefore we faint not, but though our outward man is decaying, yet our inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is for the moment, worketh for us more and more exceedingly an eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. For we know that if the earth, the house of our tabernacle, be dissolved, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Here's what Paul had convictions of that could cause him to endure the sufferings, the persecutions that are identified in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning in verse 23. So by faith, the writer says, we understand that the worlds have been framed by the word of God, so that what is seen hath not been made out of things which appear. The writer of Psalms says in chapter 33 and in verse 9 that he spake, and it was so. He spake and it stood fast. By faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he had witness borne to him that he was righteous, God bearing witness in respect of his gifts, and through it he being dead yet speaketh. Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. What made it better? His obedience. That's right, Randy. His was by faith. And how does faith come? And the passage that teaches that is, All right, very good. Now, what does that indicate when we put all that together? What did Cain do? He didn't do what he heard, and so consequently his was not an offering by faith. But through faith, Abel obtained witness that he was righteous. God testified of his righteousness, and we can see evidence of that in 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 12, as the Apostle John cites the offering of Abel and the attitude of Cain. In 1 John chapter 3, verse 12 says, "Not as Cain was the evil one and slew his brother, and wherefore slew he him? Because his works were evil and his brother's righteous." So the New Testament writer affirms the faith of Abel and how that witness is born of him being righteous. Now through his faith, he being dead yet speaks. Hebrews 11 verse 4 continues. How is it that Abel's faith yet speaks? Ken? Okay, well, the example of Abel continues to teach a lesson. Even though he's dead, his example yet teaches us. And so we can read about that here, and we can read about that in 1 John 3 and learn of Abel's faith, and his example continues to teach us. Now, Enoch was translated that he should not see death. By faith, Enoch was translated that he should not see death. And he was not found because God translated him. For he hath had witness borne to him that before his translation he had been well pleasing unto God. By his faith Enoch was translated so that he did not see death. Now the historical reference takes us back to Genesis chapter 5. Randy?
I was going to stop before
you. Okay. I'm stopped. That's right. From the beginning, Abel is recognized as righteous.
Abel is the first record we have of something
dying. That's right. That's right. That's right. And he's recognized as a righteous man. Yes. Very good. So as we look at Enoch, we find that Enoch was not. He was and he was not, for God took him. That has always impressed me. He was and then he was not. Appearing that there were those who searched for him, looked for him, and he just was not to be found because God took him. He was and was not. He was translated so that he did not see death. Can you think of another that did not see death who was taken? Elijah. That's right. And we read about that in 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. So by faith, he pleased God. Hebrews 11 verse 5 tells us, he pleased God. What does that indicate about Enoch? He heard, he obeyed. Yes, Randy?
The passage in Genesis says that he walked with God.
Yes, very important that he walked with God.
I think it's important to know that whatever that means, it's pleasing to God.
That's right. It illustrates the value of walking with God. Very impressive. Now, as we get to the next case and talk about Noah, we notice that Noah, his faith worked. But before we get to that, we need to underscore verse 6, that without faith it is impossible to be well-pleasing unto him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that seek after him. The importance of this verse, I think, is found in the theme of the book of Hebrews and the necessity of drawing nigh unto God. If we are to draw nigh or draw near unto God, then we must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. There would be no purpose of drawing near unto God if we didn't believe those things, that he is. Now, what's the basis of believing that he is? We see the evidence even in the creation that he is. and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. In every instance that we're reading about of these that are characterized by faith, we see that God blessed them. So he is a rewarder of them that diligently, and we might want to underscore that expression, that diligently seek him. Okay? Now, looking at verse 7, then by faith Noah, being warned of God concerning things not seen as yet, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, through which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. By faith, Noah, number one, being warned of God concerning things not seen as yet. Of what was Noah warned? A flood is coming. A flood had never come before. Some have supposed that because the earth was watered from the mist that it had never rained before. I don't know about that, but it's good for speculation. But the point being is, certainly a flood had never come before. And Noah is warned of such things not seen as yet. And the text tells us that he moved. He acted upon that. Yes, Ken? Right. Right.
So that would lead you to believe that however it was, whether it be a mist or whatever, it never did come out of the sky.
That's right.
It probably thought Noah was off his rock or preaching.
No doubt. No doubt. Preaching that there's going to be a flood. But there was going to be a flood, and Noah moved with godly fear. Yes.
Where civilization was at the time, they had oceans.
That's right. And can you imagine the thoughts that must have been going through the minds of those who watched Noah build that thing? By the way, how long was Noah building?
He preached for 120
years. All right, he preached for 120 years, calling upon the people to turn. Now, some have supposed that that was the time that he was building the ark, and I think that's a pretty good assumption, but he preached for 120 years, and only how many entered the ark? Only eight. Entered into the ark. But he moved with godly fear. What is godly fear? Well, yes, but it involves reverence and deep piety. And so he moved with godly fear and prepared an ark. Notice, if you will, he moved and he prepared. Noah acted when God commanded to do the things that God had instructed him to do, and through which he condemned the world. How's that? How did he condemn the world? Through his obedience.
Well, his faith and actions.
All right.
Showed the correct example and made it possible.
All right. All right. The same waters. That's right. The same waters that delivered Noah were the same waters that condemned the world. And Noah, through his preaching, condemned the world, just as Nineveh would condemn those who did not listen to Jesus. They didn't listen to what Noah had to say. And so through that he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So Noah became heir of righteousness. What's that mean? He received the standing of being right in God's eyes. He received the standing of being right. And it was his faith that so pleased God. He demonstrated the kind of faith and works, that faith and works do not conflict, but yet they complement each other. So as we look at these, we see that Noah moved with godly fear, prepared the ark. Now let's talk for a moment about Abraham. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed to go out into a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing whither he went. That tells us very simply something that is important. Abraham was not a pauper, by the way. Abraham lived in a very rich region, but Abraham was willing to leave all that simply because God said go. God did not tell him where to go. He simply said go. And Abraham arose and went unto a place that he knew not where, simply because God said, which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing whither he went. This land that he was to receive for an inheritance, what did he find when he got there? Jonathan? Other people living there. And then it caused him to prompt the question in Genesis chapter 15, how shall I know that this land is going to be mine? And what did God tell him? Anybody? Okay. God told him in Genesis chapter 15 that it's actually not going to be yours until 400 years down the pike. In the fourth generation, this land shall belong to your descendants. But before that happens, they will be taken and become captives of another nation, and then after that, I will deliver them into this land. 400 years down the pike, did Abraham become discouraged? Well, somewhat, but yet he believed what God said, and he trusted in what God said, and this passage tells us that he went out, not knowing whether he went. Verse 9, by faith he became a sojourner in the land of promise, as in a land not his own, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Now Abraham was willing to live in the land, but to live in the land as a sojourner. What's that mean? What is a sojourner? All right, somebody that travels as if they don't have a home, and that's right. You'll note you don't possess it, that's right. As did Jacob, or Isaac and Jacob. And you'll notice that said to Jacob in Genesis chapter 28, verse 13, and behold, Jehovah stood above it and said, I am Jehovah, the God of Abraham, thy father, the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. You'll notice the same promise made unto his father, to Isaac, in Genesis chapter 26, verses 3 and 4. Now the significance of that is this was the same promise that was made to Abraham, almost in identical terminology. The same promise that was made to Abraham. Abraham was a stranger and a sojourner in the land, as was his son Isaac, and as was his son Jacob, the heirs of the same promise, lived as sojourners, as pilgrims. Now what does that suggest to us about our walk? We too are described as strangers, are we not? In this land we are pilgrims, and I believe the text is found in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. He says, Beloved, I beseech you as sojourners and pilgrims to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your behavior seemly among the Gentiles, that wherein they speak against you as evildoers, they may behold, or may by your good works which they behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. We too are strangers and pilgrims. But notice the attitude with which Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were strangers and pilgrims. In verse 10, concerning Abraham, it says, For he looked for a city which hath the foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Abraham looked for something permanent. To dwell in a tent is to be one who moves about from place to place. But Abraham looked for a city which hath foundation, whose builder and maker is God. He looked for something that was permanent, something that would endure, as opposed to living in tents. In verse 11 it says, By faith even Sarah herself received power to conceive seed when she was past age, since she counted him faithful who had promised. Now this takes us back to Genesis 17. When we read in Genesis 17 of the promise being made that Sarah is going to have a child, what was her first reaction? She laughed. Did she laugh in disbelief? Or did she laugh in irony? In irony. She did not laugh in disbelief, because this text tells us that she believed God. But what did Abraham do when he was first told that he was going to have a son? He laughed too. But yet we find that even though Abraham and Sarah both laughed, It was not in disbelief. For you'll notice that in Romans, the fourth chapter, we see the faith that Abraham had when he was told that he was going to have a son. Romans, the fourth chapter. Let's pick up the reading beginning in verse 18. Speaking of Abraham, it says, "Who in hope believed against hope, to the end that he might become a father of many nations, according to that which had been spoken, so shall thy seed be. And without being weakened in faith, he considered his own body, now as good as dead, he being about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb, yet looking to the promise of God, he wavered not through unbelief, but waxed strong through faith, giving glory to God, and being fully assured that what he had promised, he was able also to perform. Wherefore, also it is reckoned unto him, or was reckoned unto him, for righteousness. Now it was not written for his sake alone that it was reckoned unto him, but for our sake also, unto whom it shall be reckoned, who believe on him that raised Jesus our Lord from the dead, who was delivered up for our trespasses and was raised for our justification." Abraham believed God. It may have seemed like a ridiculous thing that a man 100 years old and a woman who's 90 years old could have a child. But yet we notice something, I think, that's rather significant. When Sarah laughed, one of the questions that she raised was, "Shall I have pleasure in my Lord?" Now, without being graphic, we notice that Sarah understands that in order to have a child, what takes place? A physical union. That's right. And so did a physical union take place between Abraham and Sarah as evidence of their faith to conceive a child? Obviously, in the text, they did. They believed that God would produce with them a child, or that Sarah would conceive and bring forth a child. Both believed that, accounting God, who had promised, as faithful. In verse 12 now of our text, Hebrews 11, it says, "Wherefore also there sprang of one, and him as good as dead, also many as the stars of the heaven in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable." Yes, Ken?
When these three angels appeared to Abraham and Sarah, mm-hmm. they appeared in human form, right?
Right.
So with that being said, did they know that they were angels?
I don't know. I'm not sure what evidence would exist to confirm or deny that.
Because, you know, being of old age and then have three men just pop in and say you're going to have a kid, a baby. We would laugh too until they said God had promised it.
Right.
And at that time they believed it.
Right. Now, I don't know whether they recognized them as more than three men or as angels, but they believed the message. And, of course, that's what a angel is simply a messenger, and we know they were angels. The text tells us that they were. But what Abraham understood about that, I don't know what evidence would exist to tell us that. He believed what they said. Okay. Any other questions or comments? You all are just letting me rattle on. All right, let's look back at the text. In verse 12, when it talks about Abraham's seed being as many as the stars of the heaven in multitude and as the sand which is by the seashore, innumerable. What did Abraham start out with? Himself and Sarah that were old, beyond the ability to have children. And then Isaac was born. Isaac had sons, Jacob and Esau. The seed then was blessed through Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. And we notice that through the 12 sons, a family that was about the number of 70 went down into Egypt as the instructions of Joseph were given. And 70 in Egypt multiplied into over 600,000 fighting men coming up out of Egypt. Scholars tell us, when we factor in the old men, the women, and the children, that we have a number of 2 to 3 million people. That is a lot of people. 2 to 3 million people coming up out of Egypt and settling now in the new land, the land of Canaan. Verse 13 is a fascinating verse to me. It says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises." Well, what promises, when we read about Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, and Sarah, what promises do we read about that they did not receive? All right, they didn't see that. What else? Didn't see the land as it being their own. All right, didn't see much beyond that except what Abraham, the eternal city, yes. All right, they didn't see that. So as far as the three promises that we read about made to Abraham in Genesis 12, they really didn't realize any of those things. They died before all of those came to pass. But as we read the text and hold that thought, because we're going to notice it again when we get down into the text a little bit farther in verse 33. But as we see in this text, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things make it manifest that they are seeking after a country of their own. And if indeed they had been mindful of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed of them to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. Lots of neat things in that context. In this context, we see that they were strangers and pilgrims in a strange land. And in this strange land, they acknowledged that they did not belong. It was not theirs, not in fact. But also we notice in this that they did not seek to return to the land that they came from. If they had, they could have done so. That would have been an opportunity. But they did not seek to return to this land that they had left. They acknowledged that they were strangers and pilgrims in a foreign land and were content with that. Any questions or comment just here? Yes, Randy? That's right. That's right. Well, that's right. That's right. That's right. And so what did they seek for? Verse 16. All right, which is a heavenly as opposed to this earth. And that should be our attitude. The things of this world ought not be the things that we long for. But that heavenly country is what we long for. And that takes us back, as it were, to 2 Corinthians 4, 16 through chapter 5, verse 1. The things that the Apostle Paul sought was that tabernacle prepared without hands, eternal in the heavens. And if we don't seek that, beloved, we've lost everything. Okay? Another interesting thought in these verses, I think, is that God is not ashamed of them to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. If God was not ashamed of them, what was his attitude toward these great heroes of faith? Chris? He's proud of them. He's proud of them. Now, should that be an attitude that we want to cultivate with God toward us? Instead of him being ashamed of us, we want him to be proud of us. And of course, that's seen in waiting as Abraham and Sarah and these other great heroes of faith so did. In verse 17, by faith Abraham, being tried, offered up Isaac. Yea, he that had gladly received the promises was offering up his only begotten son, even he to whom it was said, in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God is able to raise up even from the dead, from whence he did also in a figure receive him back. Let's pause there. In the reading of this, we see that by faith he offered up Isaac, the promised son. What Old Testament text does this take us back to? We need to know that. Genesis 22. Pardon me? Well, 22 verses 1 through the next several verses, in fact, we see Abraham's conduct characterized by faith throughout these practices. For example, if you'll notice that God said, "Take now thy son," verse 2, "thine only son whom thou lovest, even Isaac, and get thee into the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of." Now notice verse 3. "And Abraham rose early in the morning." Did the fact that he got up early in the morning demonstrate his faith? It did. The very fact that he saddled his ass, is that a demonstration of his faith? It was. The fact that he took two of his young men with him and clave the wood for the burnt offering, is that evidence of his faith? It is. The text tells us that he went up to the place of which God had told him. Now verse 5, Mom. He says, "And Abram said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship, and come again unto you." What's the significance of what he's telling those who have traveled with him? "We will come again." He knew that he was going to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. But offering Isaac as a sacrifice means he's going to kill him. How is it going to be that I and the lad will come down off that mountain? All right, he believed that God could raise him from the dead and still do what he had promised that he would do. Now that's impressive. Abraham did not know how God would fulfill the promise, but he knew that he was going to kill Isaac because that's what God said do. He believed that God could raise him from the dead and still do what he promised that he would do. Verse 6, "Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife." I want to suggest to you that every one of these acts demonstrates the kind of faith that Abraham had. Every act that he did in preparation for the sacrifice of his son. He built the altar, verse 9. He laid the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son, and he stretched forth his hand and took the knife to kill him. Every one of those acts is a demonstration of the faith that Abraham had. He's going to kill the boy because that's exactly what God told him to do. Any questions or comments just here? Well, after the fact, go ahead. Well, maybe that's so. I don't know. That could be so. That has merit, I suppose. In verse 17, after the fact, it says that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heavens, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned unto the young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. Abraham did what he said he would do. I and the lad will go there, and we'll come again. But in the interim, God had reminded him of the validity of the promise that he had made, that in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Our faith sometimes requires dramatic things of us too. Sometimes things that maybe on the surface we wouldn't really like to do any more than Abraham. Well, that's perhaps true, but the text tells us that God tried Abraham here in our text of Hebrews 11. So from the standpoint of what God knew and what he didn't know, I've taken the position in the past on this that God chose not to know. That an all-knowing, omnipotent God could choose not to know some things. And to prove Abraham, this was the test. Just a thought.
The choice still has to be made. Abraham had to have a choice.
Right.
If he had chose wrongly, God can still carry out his plan by other means.
Well, now that's an interesting thought and very much on target. We find that even though there were efforts during the plan of God or during the fulfillment of the plan of God to thwart that plan, God was always able to use it and to circumvent the blockades that man had placed in the way, to circumvent those and still fulfill his plan anyway. For example, when it would appear that the nation of Israel was going to be stamped out during the time of Esther, we find that God provided, even through Esther, through the king, Artaxerxes, I think, but through the king to spare those people, and that by giving them the privilege of defending themselves. So what would seem like a plan of man to circumvent the plan or to stamp out the plan of God, God used that to circumvent the plans of man and fulfill his promise anyway. So God could do that. Good point.
I just remember when we were studying the nations, the timeline thing,
make a great nation out of him.
And of course he did. He brought in the idols from Egypt and stuff. So God had ways of doing what that we can't comprehend and stuff. So he still can bring it about no matter what man does to try to stop him. And that's why premillennialists always aggravate me. Saying that the Jews, stopped God's plan and
Yes. Nothing overthrew the plan of God. Nothing will. Any other questions or comments? Does that kind of help a little bit,
sure
maybe?
Does.
All right, Jonathan? Obedience goes with blessings, too. And faith goes with obedience.
Okay, we David. Can see in the story of Abraham how his faith grew. And there was a time when he lied about Sarah being his sister and things because he didn't put his full trust in God. And there at the end, when he's willing to offer his own son, believing that God will raise him from the dead, that shows how much Abraham had grown in faith.
Well, that's right. And three times I think it's interesting that Abraham was referred to as the friend of God. He bears the only distinction in all of the scriptures being called the friend of God, and that three times. Randy?
Just to say you're talking about thwarting God's plan. Abraham was the friend of God, but in Exodus 32,
how would you like to try that?
Well, it's an impressive passage, but the point is that God can decide for himself.
That's right.
What he wants to do.
That's right.
His will be done. And in this case, he would destroying the people that he's brought out of the land of Egypt.
That's right. But he could still go ahead and fulfill
that,
his promise.
That thing, because he said, he called you out of my great nation. He don't have to have 12 tribes. He could have started with Moses and started the nation right there.
That's right. Still would have been the seed of Abraham. That's right. Yeah. Impressive point, isn't it? All right. Very good. Appreciate you thinking of that. Catch up in my notes with where I am. Oh, I was making the point that sometimes our faith causes us to make some hard decisions, much like Abraham's faith caused him to make a very hard decision in offering up his son Isaac as a sacrifice upon the altar. But if you'll turn in your New Testament to Luke, the 14th chapter, Luke, the 14th chapter, reading beginning at verse 26, "If any man cometh unto me and hateth not his own father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple." And then, of course, we began to read about the considering or counting the cost, a man building a tower, a man going out to war, and so forth. But when the text tells us, "If any man that cometh to me hateth not his own father, mother, wife, children, brethren, and sisters, even his own life," what is the idea here being presented? To hate these people or hate these relationships? Does it mean hate with the idea of despising? What is it then? All right, we love them less than we love God. And it has to be that way. Abraham loved his son Isaac, but he loved him less than he loved God. Now, I find it interesting when God called upon Abraham to sacrifice his son. He said, "Take now thy son, thine only son, whom thou lovest, even Isaac." God certainly knew the relationship that existed between Abraham and Isaac, the closeness of that relationship, because no doubt the child was born in Abraham's old age. God, knowing that, knew the severity of the test, as it were, that it would be unto Abraham. But Abraham passed the test because he loved God more than he loved his own son. Well, that's right. He would be doing the same thing, and did. All right. Well, dropping back over into our text, Hebrews chapter 11. Picking up the reading at verse 20. It says, "By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even concerning things to come. By faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped." Let's pause there. When the text tells us that he blessed Jacob and Esau, as we turn back to the Old Testament text, and it escapes me right at the moment where that is. Here it is, Genesis chapter 27. Genesis chapter 27, that whole chapter. We read about Abraham blessing Jacob and Esau, but in the text we see that there was a blessing that was given unto Jacob, and the text doesn't really reveal anything to us about a blessing being given unto Esau. How do we reconcile that? Genesis 27, 1 through 40. We'll not read all of that, but we will cite just a couple of passages in that. For example, beginning at verse 27 of Genesis 27, it says, "He came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his raiment and blessed him," that is Jacob, "and said, See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which Jehovah hath blessed. And God gave thee of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and new wine. Let people serve thee and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be every one that curseth thee, and blessed be every one that blesseth thee." Here we see very simply the blessing of Abraham upon Jacob. But how is it that our text tells us that he blessed Esau?
But he was blessing Esau.
Well, That's right. He thought that he was, but he didn't, in fact.
Esau, he was blessing Jacob, or what it said was, he was blessing the blessing of the church. So he would be in on that part of the blessing.
All right, I think that's true. And the details of that simply are not given. We don't know what was involved in that.
You know, later on, they didn't.
They reconciled between the two of them. They reconciled. But Esau developed into the nation of the Edomites. And, of course, through Jacob, we find the promised seed. The Israelites begin to develop, and through them, of course, the coming of the Christ. So, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. The things to come were down the pike somewhere. They didn't realize those things at the time that the blessing was given. But down the pike somewhere, these things were fulfilled concerning things yet to come. Verse 21, by faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph. Now who were they? All right, no, not the 12.
Manasseh
and Ephraim. That's right. Manasseh and Ephraim were blessed. In fact, you'll notice that Jacob received Manasseh and Ephraim even as his own sons. And they became larger than any of the tribes of the sons of Jacob. So we find that Manasseh and Ephraim were indeed blessed of Jacob. And his blessing involved the promises of God, showing how he embraced them also. Now in verse 21, by faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. By faith Joseph, when his end was nigh, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. What was it that Joseph said about his bones? Be buried, carried back, and buried in the land of Canaan. Moses respected that wish as it came time to leave Egypt, carrying the bones of Joseph. And Joshua buried Joseph's bones in Joshua chapter 24 and in verse 32. Did I say that right? Joshua buried Joseph's bones. I thought I turned it around. Joshua buried Joseph's bones in the text of Joshua 24, verse 32. So we learn a great deal about faith. When Joseph was near the end of his life, he made mention of the promises that God had made. And it might behoove us to turn and read those promises or the things that Joseph had on his mind when he died. Had that in front of me and let it go. Genesis chapter 50. And in verse 25 and 26, and Joseph took the oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Joseph reminds them of the very thing that God had promised, that they would come out of this land and go into the land that God had promised. We out of time, Chris? That was the second buzzer. Okay.
That's where Sarah was Abraham came.
That's right. That's right. And that was all that he owned. That was all that Abraham owned in the land of Canaan.
Oh, that's the only part of the land that
he actually owned.